Welcome back to the program. The election of 2008 certainly changed everything, but not exactly in the ways we think. For the irony is that for all the drama and seeming cultural upheaval caused by the election of an African-American president, it was perhaps Hillary Clinton's 18 million cracks in the glass ceiling and Sarah Palin's attempt to co-opt it that may now have the most far-reaching impact on our politics and our culture. This is the backdrop for one of the most insightful and thought-provoking books written about the 2008 campaign. Its author is Rebecca Traister. She's a senior writer for Salon, where she's written about women, politics, media, and entertainment. She covered the 2008 presidential campaign. She's also written for Elle, The Nation, and The New York Times. It is my pleasure to welcome her back to this program to talk about the paperback release of her book, Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. Rebecca Traister, thanks so much for joining us again.
Thank you so much for having me back, Jeff.
As you look back 3.5 years past that election, has anything changed? Has that election really changed everything as we look now going into a new presidential election cycle?
Well, I think it absolutely has. I mean, the ubiquity of, I shouldn't actually use the word ubiquity, but think about the fact that in the upcoming Republican primary, we're going to have we already have one woman involved, and we likely will have two when Sarah Palin makes it official. And that, I'm not suggesting that those women aren't going to face sexism, that it's not still unusual to have women in the contest, but it's so much less unusual. It's like we can't even remember back 3 years to before Hillary Clinton. We had never had a woman who was taken seriously as a serious major party presidential contender. Shirley Chisholm had run in the 1970s and 1972. We had runs by Carol Moseley Braun and Elizabeth Dole, but we had never had any woman up there as a major party candidate in the way that Hillary Clinton was. And now we're looking at what everybody's talking about, Michelle Bachmann, as one of the most serious candidates for the Republican nomination. This is the way in which we're becoming more open to this is happening so quickly. In fact, it's happening so quickly we barely see how quickly it's happening because we can't even remember what it was like 3 or 4 years ago, how unlikely it would have been to be looking at a Republican field that is likely going to include two women.
How much of this is as a result of the changes from the 2008 campaign, Sarah Palin and Hillary Clinton? How much of it comes from the changes that came out of that campaign? And how much of it is as a result of a general sense in the country that things aren't going very well and maybe we have to look at things differently?
Well, it's obviously, it's both. To suggest that there's only one factor behind this would be dishonest. I would say that the ways in which what 2008 did for us, it would be false to suggest that it cured any of our problems with regard to misogyny or racism or anything like that. But what having different kinds of candidates, whether they're women, whether they're African Americans, whether they're Latino, what it does is it expands the number of kinds of candidates we can imagine in the future. So once we see a female candidate for president, it's much easier to then consider two more female candidates for president, and then four more, and then six more down the road. So in that respect, having candidates like Hillary Clinton, like Sarah Palin, having a candidate like Barack Obama, like Bill Richardson, what that does is change the scope of how we can envision presidential power. So it's not just white men as it had been for 220 years before 2008. So in that regard, the variety of candidates and the seriousness of their campaigns absolutely exploded our world as far as, wow, we can suddenly imagine all these different kinds of people. Now that kind of expansion of imaginative possibility happens to be occurring at a moment where there is an enormous amount of frustration. There was an enormous amount of frustration leading up to 2008, frustration with the Bush administration, with the ongoing wars, with America's declining reputation around the world. We now see that frustration with the economic problems at home. And so the expansion of possibility for who could lead us happens to dovetail with what the country feels is its need to change things. In 2008, we felt that need to change after 8 years of the Bush administration. There is now on the right a feeling that you know, there's frustration with the current administration. You know, so somebody like Michelle Bachmann, somebody like Sarah Palin can come in, and they're so different that it offers people hope. Oh, this is going to change the status quo. So I think the things are those factors are working in concert.
Does it seem odd or counterintuitive in some ways that so many of the women that people are talking about in politics right now, political views aside, are all coming from the right, whether it's Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin or Sharon Engel and Nikki Haley and on and on?
Well, I would say they're not all coming from the right. I would say there are a couple things that the media does to sort of twist our perspective of who all the women in politics are right now. The reason we're talking about Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin is because there's a Republican primary in which you have a bunch of Republicans trying to get your attention, right? There's not a Democratic primary. So you don't have the same number of people trying to grab the American imagination and appeal to voters in the same way that you have on the Republican side. So that's why we're talking about Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin. It's true that on the Democratic side, you have Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who just took over as the head of the DNC. You have Hillary Clinton, who is the Secretary of State. You have people like Amy Klobuchar. And certainly for very tragic reasons, there's been an enormous amount of attention on Gabby Giffords, an incredibly talented politician who unfortunately was shot earlier this year.
Right.
So it's not just that these women are coming up on the right. They are also present on the left. But the other thing I really want to stress is that we get a lot of focus when it comes to women in politics on the slightly batty women, the candidates who fulfill our worst expectations, and the media directs that kind of focus. So in the 2010 midterms, there was this obsession with Sharon Engel, who was saying sort of racist things. There was an obsession with Christine O'Donnell, the candidate in Delaware, who was saying pretty stupid things. There is an obsession with every one of Bachmann's, sort of speaking errors. And it would give you the impression that all we've got are these sort of, dumb ladies, right? But we have to think about the way that focus on those candidates is a kind of wish fulfillment for people who still expect or would like to see that image of the ditzy female candidate, and then thus push the focus on those women. And what we didn't see was a lot of focus on the other very competent women, both Democratic and Republican, who were running. We didn't, until very recently, have much attention on Nikki Haley, the extraordinarily competent, I happen to disagree with her politics, but the extraordinarily competent female politician, the governor of South Carolina. We haven't seen enough focus on the Debbie Wasserman Schultz, on Amy Klobuchar, and that's because there is all this focus on the women who misspeak, and very little focus on the men who make the same kinds of errors and say stupid things and who say racist things. We don't hear nearly as much about them because there's not the same element of wish fulfillment.
What impact, though, is that going to have on the general perception of women candidates that the media is so focused on the crazy, loopy things from people like Sharon Engel and Michelle Bachmann and Sarah Palin?
Well, that's the thing we still have to battle our way through. The fact is, I don't mean to behave as though Michelle Bachmann doesn't say crazy things. She does. So there's an extent to which the coverage of it, it's fair. Nobody's putting words in her mouth. But what we have to sort of make an effort to keep in mind and to keep talking about is the way in which those sort of silly errors are blown up by the media. And it's a process of, again, getting used to having female candidates and being able to be smart about the media we consume about them. So, yes, it will have an impact. You are definitely left with the impression that there are all these dopey female candidates out there. And so we have to be able to be smart about both acknowledging when they are a little dopey and about saying, wait a minute, who else is out there? What other women are we not hearing about? And what's the dopiness of the guys that we're not hearing about? I mean, certainly Rick Santorum, Herman Cain, Mitt Romney, these people all have crazy stories about them, and they misspeak and they say ridiculous things. And we simply don't hear about it with the same kind of zeal with which Michelle Bachmann's errors are covered. And so there's little we can do to change that. What we can do is become increasingly aware of it, and conscious of it and try to think about it as we're making our assessments of the candidates in front of us.
The other part of it is that the impact that that coverage, skewed as it may be in the ways that you're talking about, the impact that it has on young women that might be coming up into the political arena or might be considering being involved in politics and how it might affect them.
Well, there's always been a lot of information and a lot of reason that young women have been wary of politics. And by the way, some of the reasons that the people of both genders are wary about getting into politics are good. You have your life exposed. There's a loss of privacy. There's a constant sort of asking for money, working within a very rigid party system that asks you perhaps to compromise more than you would like to. There are all kinds of things about our political system that make it unappealing for young people, both male and female. And of course for women, as well as for minorities, for, for racial, sexual, ethnic, religious minorities, the scrutiny is so much worse. And the prejudice that they're going to face is so much more intense that they're extra, you know, things that might dissuade them from joining. And of course, the focus on every gaffe made by a female politician might put off any number of smart women. But the thing is, that's not exactly how it's happening. You and I could sit around and say, wow, this is really going to keep women from getting involved. But the fact is, young women are expressing interest in getting into politics more than ever before with every one of these candidates. And I actually mean this very seriously, including Sarah Palin, including Michelle Bachmann, including Hillary Clinton. Young women are seeing, wait a minute, that's a possible career for me. And even though it's going to be hard, even though they recognize the challenges ahead of them, even though they recognize that there are going to be frustrations and roadblocks for them, they seem to be expressing interest in getting into politics. More women signed up to run in the 2010 election. Not all of them wound up following through the whole campaign. Than ever before. Programs like the White House Project report exploded participation amongst young women who want to train to get into political life. And that's one of the things, when we talk about how few women there have been in the national eye when it comes to politics, that has meant that for young women there was no model. There was no sense of, oh, that's something I could do one day. I certainly had no model for that when I was a young person. Geraldine Ferraro was one of the very first female politicians I remember, and thinking, huh, but I knew what an anomaly she was. The more female politicians we see out there, the more young women think, oh, that's a possibility for me. And so, in fact, even though all this evidence is, you know, ample evidence, is, you know, offers ample information about how difficult it will be for women, we also have to remember that simply seeing the women out there fighting it out provides such inspiration for younger women to want to follow in their footsteps.
To what extent do you think that there has been an impact, a positive impact for women, by the seeming explosion in stories about the peccadilloes of male politicians?
Well, I think there's a great impact for women in that there's this perception that women are not going to get into the same kinds of trouble. I think I have certainly listened to female politicians and to leaders of groups that support more women in politics make reference to these male sex scandals and try to make the argument, look, this isn't going to happen with women. And what's up with these guys in power? This is what they're doing with their days, taking pictures of themselves in the congressional gym. And I understand that line of argument, and I think there's certainly validity to it. I am wary of any argument that suggests that women are not going to have the same, for example, are not going to have the same kind of scandals that men do. I think there's a long history. We idealize those who are not in power. What we get as a trade-off for not being in power is we get to have a fantasy that if we were in power, everything would be better. There'd be peace, and women would be collaborative, and they'd work together, and they wouldn't have any sex scandals. But the fact is, when you get real-life, flesh-and-blood women in power, they're not going to be as perfect as we imagine. And if we set our standards too high for them, if we say they're all going to be pure and chaste, and they're not going to engage, and they're not going to be corrupt, and they're not going to be warmongers. What you're going to get is a bunch of women who can't possibly meet that bar because they're made of the same stuff that their male peers are. I'm nervous about that argument.
The underlying difference, though, and somebody wrote this recently, and I wish I could remember immediately who, that men and women often come to politics, get involved in politics, for different reasons, whether it's for power on the one hand, which is a stronger motivation for men, or for more idealistic reasons. And again, to your point, that's not to say they're not going to become corrupted or do things that get them involved in scandals, but the initial entry motivations are fundamentally different.
And I think that is, at the moment, given the history and the current layout of who's in politics and who holds office, I think that argument is very valid right now. But the thing is, we can't disassociate the fact that throughout history, power for men has been intimately connected to sexual power and sexual appeal. And for women, the inverse has been true.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you were an ambitious or powerful woman, you were somehow less sexually appealing, right? So when it comes to talking about how each gender approaches their job, their powerful job, and their sexual or personal conduct, we can't forget that the very basics of how we associate those things are different depending on whether you're a man or whether you're a woman. And I think that what would change over time, and I have no idea, would women have as many sex scandals? It would take hundreds of years of a reversal of those associations for us to be able to actually know or guess whether or not women would have the same tendencies in equal numbers or equal percentages as their male peers do. But for right now, I do think it's fair to observe that women pursue politics for different reasons, and that in part it's because what history has taught us is that the pursuit of politics will offer different opportunities if you're a man or you're a woman. And that we have to remember that there's this very complicated baggage, sexual, powerful, political, all associated with these jobs. So that, yes, but that observation, I think, right now is perfectly valid, that men and women see political power differently and get into politics for different reasons.
Will it make any difference in the big picture of this, do you think, if we go into the 2012 presidential election with no women on the ticket, that the Democratic team stays the same, and the Republicans wind up with, you know, Mitt Romney and Tim Pawlenty. I mean, you pick. But,
right.
But if no women wind up in the national race, what does that mean?
Well, you know, I don't know that in itself it means anything. I think it would probably be a speed bump. When I talk about the kind of change that we're seeing and how many more women we're seeing on the scene and how much easier it's getting for us to envision women on presidential tickets, on debate stages, I think having a four-man presidential race would be a speed bump, and it would feel, frankly, slightly retro. And that's not to say that I'm supporting the candidacy of either Michelle Bachmann or Sarah Palin, but I think right now there's so much talk about women in politics that it would kind of be anticlimactic if we had an all-male presidential race.
Mm-hmm.
But it might happen. I mean, probability suggests there are still way more men in the Republican field than there are women. So, and there's no sign that there's going to be a change in the Democratic ticket in the vice presidential slot, although there were early rumors about
rumors,
a possible switch between Biden and Hillary Clinton. There's nothing to suggest that's going to be true. So I think it would be a little bit anticlimactic. However, I think for all the people, and there are millions of them out there, who have become really energized and invested in the idea of putting a woman on a presidential ticket, putting a woman in the White House, I think it would probably make them double down and be even more invested in 2016, when I think we have a lot of women coming up who could hypothetically be on both sides. And so whether or not we see a woman on a presidential ticket in 2012, I personally will be very surprised and disappointed if we don't see one or two in 2016.
Yeah, I mean, the very fact, and I think your point is right, that if you see four men up there, you know, at the end of the day, it will be perceived, I think, in general, as being kind of retro, and I think that says a lot in and of itself.
Well, there's a degree. I should point out, when I say it's going to be retro, the fact that one of those men is African American, which is still mind-boggling and thrilling, right? And this is what I say about the speed with which we get used to all this stuff,
right?
Is that we forget what it was like 4 years ago. And so when we talk about the retro presidential race, in which the incumbent president is actually an African American, it's not quite retro. It feels retro, and the very fact we can say that is remarkable. But in fact, the fact that the incumbent president is black is still mind-boggling. So I should note that. But yes, the fact of a four-man ticket would feel almost anachronistic at this point, which is incredible.
Finally, talk a little bit about separating out the gender issues from the political issues, that you can look at the Republican side, for example, and be positive in some ways about Sarah Palin or Michelle Bachmann, while at the same time agreeing with them about virtually nothing.
Right. Well, I actually feel that way about Sarah Palin quite often. Since I wrote my book, my book, and in fact, my politics are so at odds with Sarah Palin. There is almost no word that's ever emerged from her mouth that I agree with. And I have been very critical of her, and I'm very critical of her in the book, though I also write in the book about the things that were historic and remarkable and admirable and worth noting about her vice presidential run. But the funny thing is, I have grown increasingly fond of her in recent years, and that doesn't mean that I ever want to see her in elected office again. But there's something that I have grown to sort of ruggedly admire about her insistence on breaking all the conventional rules. Because I think this is one of the exciting things. It's something we saw Barack Obama do when he ran for president. He defied expectations in every way possible, not only the expectation that it would be impossible to elect a black man president, but that, for example, young people never come out to vote, everybody tells us. Well, he broke that rule. They came out to vote for Barack Obama. People tell us that there's one way to run for president. There's one way to be a politician. And that one way that we're told about is based on two centuries of white male political power. And so when you have new kinds of people who offer new kinds of inspiration and bring new strategies, new ideas to the mix, suddenly you see these people breaking rules. It's something Hillary Clinton did. She kept defying expectations. Oh, she'll be out by Super Tuesday. She'll lose in New Hampshire. She has to get out of the race. The fact is, she kept breaking the rules. All the prognosticators were surprised every time she won a big contest. They were sure she was going to lose. Sarah Palin is doing a similar thing. When she quit her term as governor of Alaska, everyone said, because this is what history had told us, that her political career was over. And I certainly hope that career as an elected official is over. But what didn't happen is that she didn't disappear. She went off the rails, and she just kept trucking, and she defied everybody's expectations, and she defied every political prognostication. And there's a point where I have to say I really appreciate those candidates out there, regardless of whether I agree with them or not, who are shaking things up, who are saying, wait a minute, those old rules don't necessarily apply in a political universe in which there are going to be all kinds of new people participating. And so for that, I kind of have grown slightly warmer towards Sarah Palin.
Let me suggest, though, that there's a fundamental difference, that within any kind of a professional situation, politics, business, you know, whatever you'd like, that breaking all the rules or setting out to break all the rules and do it your way is fine if you bring discipline to the table. And arguably that's exactly what Barack Obama did. That's what others have done who have tried to break the rules and then execute around that by bringing discipline to the exercise. To try and break the rules and not bring discipline to the exercise, which is arguably what Sarah Palin has done, it becomes more entertainment than rule breaking.
Well, I think that is true. And you'll note that Barack Obama is president and Sarah Palin doesn't have an official political job. So I think there is a degree to which, I guess the political market fixes these things, right? And notes that some people bring discipline and that some people don't. I agree that what Palin is providing right now is a form of entertainment, again, she doesn't have a real job in politics. But the fact that she is, what she's letting the country know, what her behavior and is letting the country know, is that politics are changing with the inclusion of new people. She doesn't, she's not the vice president, she's not the president, she's not even governor anymore. So it's not as though she's being rewarded with a job. But I do think the degree to which she's shaking things up, there was a very smart piece in the New York Times a few weeks ago comparing her totally nutty bus trip with Mitt Romney's right. announcement that he was going to join the race. And the Times piece, which I thought was brilliant, it was by Mark Leibovich, suggested that there was something appealing about Palin's new way of doing things. And, of course, we look down our nose at it. It's a reality show. It's crazy bus trip. But the fact is, a lot of the pageantry and performance around traditional presidential politics is just as fake. You know, the Tom Harkin steak fry in Iowa that all the hopeful presidential candidates have to go to and do the Pledge of Allegiance with their flag pins on, we accept that as part of the political process because it's been going on for so long. And because it's male, it's establishment, it's what we're used to. But it's just as silly as the reality show stuff. And so I think that, you know, again, you're right. What she's doing is entertainment. It's not politics. But I think it is stretching us and challenging our old sort of calcified ideas of what politics and the political and presidential process is supposed to look like. And I think that's a good thing. I do think it's a good thing because the old process arguably may or may not have worked, but it certainly was an exclusive process. It was one that left out scads of people. And so I think it needs to be changed. And it doesn't necessarily need to be changed to fit Sarah Palin's model. But everyone who comes and takes a crack at it opens it up a little bit for other kinds of models, too.
Rebecca Traister, her book is Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women. It is just out in paperback. Rebecca, it's always a pleasure. I thank you so much for spending time with us.
I thank you very much. It's really fun.